Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Danielle Green. Danielle Green has many things in her background which are going to be interesting. Born on the south side of Chicago, became a star basketball player for the University of Notre Dame. Later was a teacher, joined the army, went to Iraq, had her arm blown off, came back, recovered, and has a special story about how all this fits together with her life and what she's doing today to help others. Danielle Green, With Respect. Danielle, how are you today?
I'm doing well, John. How are you?
I'm great. Danielle, I always start this question, the first question I have for anybody, and after that it's just discussion. Where are you from originally?
I am from the south side of Chicago.
And which I am too.
Inglewood yeah? community. Yes, sir.
Not far from that. I was down in around Dorchester and 72nd is when about where we lived for a while. So, tell me about your life. How did you get going? Where did you go to school? What did you do?
I went to Brian Piccolo. I don't know if people are familiar with Brian Piccolo, but that's on the west side of Chicago. And that's where I got my early beginnings of playing basketball on the 6th, 7th, and 8th grade team. And after my 8th grade year, then I moved to the Inglewood community with my grandmother, where I stayed with her from 14 to age 18. Mm-hmm. But instead of going to Marshall High School, which was well known at the time, or going to a Southside school, I decided to go to a Northside school. I went to a Roosevelt High School on the north side of Chicago.
Why?
I just felt like, you know, I knew I wanted to go to the University of Notre Dame, so I wanted
whoa.
To give...
Wait a minute. Now, you're eighth grade.
Yes, sir.
And you decided you want to go to the University of Notre Dame at eighth grade?
Actually, at the age of 7, I knew I wanted to go to the University of Notre Dame.
All right. How did that start?
So, back in the mid-80s, I remember there was a recession. And mm-hmm. my mother, she used to work at a bank. I think she was a teller at Continental Bank, and they closed down decades ago. And when this recession hit, my mother lost her job, and she started to, smoke weed. And then the weed went to cocaine, and then she found comfort in crack cocaine. Well, I saw this from the ages of 5, 6, 7, and 8. And it was very... it was very hurtful at the time. You know, it hurt because I saw our family just tear apart because of crack cocaine. And I remember, I'm an only child, I remember on Saturday afternoons watching football. I was starting to watch football around the age of 7. And I remember this team that used to come on every Saturday on NBC. And they had gold helmets on. And they had a touchdown Jesus and a golden dome. And so every weekend I'm watching this team. And I said, man, this place must be special. And you know, you're a kid, and so you're already imaginary play and fantasy play. And I'm like, well, this is the school where I want to go because this place looks special. So I remember telling my mom around the age of 7 that I was going to go to the University of Notre Dame. And she said we were too poor to go. And I said, that's okay, watch me, I'll figure out a way to go there. And so that's where my passion and love for the University of Notre Dame came from.
What about your dad?
I was born out of wedlock. My dad was already married, had 3 other kids, so I didn't really see too much of him during my early childhood. I would see him maybe once a year, and that was it. So it was primarily my mother and I and my grandmother, and then eventually it was my auntie and then her child and then another cousin. So it was just that, but my dad was absent at the time.
Mm-hmm. All right. You see this thing on television, the Golden Dome, the touchdown Jesus, yes. All of this. Mm-hmm. And now you decide at age
7,
you're going there. And yes. Your way to go there was what?
I didn't know at the time because I wasn't playing basketball. I knew girls didn't play football. So I didn't really have a plan at that time. until...
Thanks, because when I was seven, I didn't have a plan.
Right, I didn't have a plan, but that was something that gave me hope. Hope for a better life, because I knew what I was seeing in the house wasn't healthy. And I knew because my grandmother, I would tell my grandmother the things that I was seeing in the house. And she kind of educated me, kind of schooled me on what was going on. And I just knew this wasn't the life that I wanted to live. One day I was just roaming the streets, because that's what you did. You just roam the streets. And I remember finding a deflated basketball. Now, it wasn't completely deflated, but it had just enough air where I could bounce it, but not fully bounce it. And I remember taking that ball home and rinsing it off and finding a milk crate, because back then they had milk crates nailed down to telephone poles. And I just remember walking around just trying to find some place to shoot this deflated basketball. And so I started putting two together and saying, you know what, maybe I can play basketball in college, you know, and maybe I could make good grades. And I still didn't know about what a scholarship was. I learned about that later on. And so over time, you know, I was left-handed as well. Over time, people would say, man, if you can get that left hand together, you're going to be a special ball player. So I remember somebody bought me a bike, and I would tell my mom, hey, I'm going bike riding. But really, I would go to the local high school and I would play with the guys to start to practice my craft. And over time, I just realized that maybe I could play basketball at the University of Notre Dame. And I remember in the fifth grade, I wrote an essay saying that I was going to attend the University of Notre Dame on a basketball scholarship. So I set the plan in motion early on.
So Roosevelt, though, now Marshall, now wait a minute now, Marshall had a great basketball tradition. They're always one of the top teams in the state of Illinois come the tournaments.
Yes, sir.
But Roosevelt, I'm not so sure about Roosevelt.
No history.
No history.
At Roosevelt High School. Well, one reason I couldn't go to Marshall is because my mom went to Marshall. And so she automatically said no, and it was in a bad neighborhood, and she said no to it. So that was out the question. And Coach Gators recruited me, but my mother said no. Roosevelt came to the service because I didn't stay too far from Roosevelt when I lived on the west side.
Oh, I see.
And so I was already enrolled there, so I had to make a decision once I moved to the south side whether to go to Kenwood High School or just stay at Roosevelt. And so I decided that for me, if I was trying to go to Notre Dame, that I needed to go to Roosevelt. I felt like Roosevelt gave me my best chance.
Okay. So you did.
And so I did. So I tell people, and I love this story, I took two trains and a bus for 4 years, 25 miles to get to high school. So I was up every day at 5 a.m., I left out the house at 5:30 to catch the bus at 5:35 to catch the green line to the brown line, and then walk the rest of the way to be at school on time at 7 o'clock for JROTC.
Wait a minute. You started at 5 or 5:30
every day for almost 4 years. Yeah, that's how committed to the process that I was to get to Notre Dame.
All right. Look, you're lots of people grow up and they identify with a basketball hero, a baseball hero, a politician, an artist, whatever it happens to be. Many mm-hmm. times kids say, I want that, or I want to be like that. And we always kid around about how, you know, and I did this I did it in baseball, and I would dream about striking people out because mm-hmm. I was a pitcher.
Uh-huh.
And I would dream about a chance to shoot the final shot, because I also played basketball,
right
at the last second. And this, we joke about this. This is part of our system. But this is something you lived.
Yeah, I lived. This was my dream. This was my reality. I just knew that I did not want to stay in the inner city of Chicago. So if that meant traveling 25 miles across town.
All right. Look, there are... many, many, many people who come up in those kinds of surroundings that you've described,
mm-hmm.
and they either can't or don't make the internal decision to do those things which are going to take them out to a different place.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you do it? Why? What's inside of you? What was inside of you when you were 8 and 9, 10, 12, 14 years old?
Like I said before, John, I think just hope for a better life.
Okay.
You know, it was so hard. You know, can you imagine, you know, being in an apartment, a dilapidated building with rodents, you know, crawling underneath your bed and you're trying to get rest, or, you know, not having heat in the house or not having electric, and you're putting the milk or whatever you have, if you have food there, in between, you know, the back door and the screen door so it can stay cold. I just knew if I could figure out some way to mm-hmm. to have something to look forward to in life, that this I could overcome the situation.
One of the things that people growing up have, especially, you know, it's boys and girls, but maybe in different ways, but still boys and girls mm-hmm. have peer groups. All right. And we look on the people who don't associate with peer groups as loners. Mm-hmm. All right. Did you have peer groups that around you that were going to lead you one way or the other?
I did. Later on in life, I started working at a candy store at around 11 years old. And I realized people join gangs because they're looking for that sense of belongingness and that sense mm-hmm. of love. And there was gangs staring right at me, right at that candy store. And the temptation was there mm-hmm. to go a different path or to give in, you know. But in the back of my head, that's why Notre Dame is so special to me, because in the back of my head, I knew that joining a gang or going or not performing well in school, that was going to keep me stuck in that environment that I so desperately wanted to escape. So, yeah, there was all sorts of peer pressure. And by all means, I was not a great student early on. There was some struggle there, because when you're hungry, when there's neglect, when there's emotional abuse, how can you focus on your studies? So mm-hmm. there were behavioral issues early on, maybe fourth, sixth, and seventh grade. You know, it was really hard. I got expelled a couple of times because I didn't want to listen to authority. And I knew my mother, she had my back. She would listen to me, listen to whatever I said. But at some point in the eighth grade, I had an epiphany, and I said, you're not going down the right route. And then I would see that golden dome again and that touchdown Jesus, and then I would get refocused. And I was a pretty good ball player at the time, too, and I saw the potential in me. And then others around me started to see the potential, although they didn't understand the journey. I understood the journey, but other people didn't understand the journey and this focus. When I went to Roosevelt High School, my focus became laser. It was none of those negative outside influences was going mm-hmm. to deter me from where I needed to go.
All right. So you went to Marshall. I'm sorry, to Roosevelt.
Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm. You succeeded there?
I did. Very successful. ROTC, I was lieutenant colonel. That's as high as you can go.
Mm-hmm.
I played basketball for 4 years. I played volleyball for two or three. I ran track and I played softball. High school became a place of serenity for me, I guess, or peace, if you want to call mm-hmm. it, because mm-hmm. I was away from all this chaos at home. So I was away from home from 5:30 to about 7:30 every single day. But that's what I needed to keep my sanity, because once I came back home, you just didn't know what you were in for. And it home was safe now because I was with my grandmother. Although my mother stayed with us, my grandmother, there's no way in the world she's not going to pay her rent, or we're not going to have food on the table. So from 14 to 18, my family situation was a little better, but it was still chaotic because mm-hmm. you had all these different people in the home. So I just did everything I could to ensure myself that, you know, Notre Dame would come knocking on the door. And I would share my dream with people that, hey, I'm going to Notre Dame. And they would laugh at me. Mm-hmm. Hey, nobody believed me. And at the time, there was not internet. So I didn't even know the magnitude of what the University of Notre Dame was all about. I didn't know they were known for high academics and very clean, very smart, very rigorous, university. I didn't know all those things. I'm mm-hmm. just going off of what the 7-year-old saw,
mm-hmm.
you know. But over time, people was like, "Do you know what you're really saying?" And I'm like, "I guess not." You know, enlighten me. So
you graduated from high school. You ended up at Notre Dame. How did you end up at Notre Dame?
How did I end up at Notre Dame? Well, like I said before, John, I would tell people that I wanted to attend the University of Notre Dame. So I believe some people, they must have contacted Coach McGraw, or Coach McGraw just happened to be at the Maine West summer tournament. I was playing with another basketball team. I was overcoming a migraine headache. She sat there waiting for this migraine to succumb. I come in the game. I shoot a couple of jump shots. I hear from some coaches that she wants me. So I went on an unofficial visit. Mm-hmm. I love the university. And then I went on a official visit and went to a hockey game and participated in some activities. And I told myself at that point in time, I would not leave campus without verbally committing to her. And that was the summer of 94, I believe, that I committed to her at breakfast at the Morris Inn.
Wow. Yeah, all right. We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Danielle Green, who is a star athlete. We've been talking about the struggles she had in fulfilling a dream, okay? But we're going to find out a lot more about her and how the zigs and zags of her life have made her the person she is. This is John Smetanka, and we're on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect. We're talking to Danielle Green. Yes, she's a star athlete, which you're going to find out about in a minute, but also some other things happened before that and after that, which make her a unique person. All right, this is John Smetanka. Danielle, you committed, which is a process that very complicated process for recruiting and agreeing to go to a school, an athletic, especially a Division I school, to get an athletic scholarship. And you had to commit right away.
Yes.
You felt you had to. You didn't have wait for coaches from around the country to come in and sweet talk you and say we got a better climate down in South Texas,
right,
than we have at Notre Dame. You know.
Right.
All right. So you agreed to do it. What happened then?
Well, I agreed to play for the University of Notre Dame, and I came, and I was happy as could be. Like, I had fulfilled my dream, but I forgot that you have to continuously work to improve. You know, mentally, physically, emotionally, but it stopped for me. It just stopped. You know, my attitude, my mentality wasn't right coming into the game. I didn't realize the game was, you know, people are taller, people are stronger, people are physically intimidating. And, you know, for me, I was just like stuck. I was stuck my freshman year. I did okay in the classroom. I held my own in the classroom. But on the basketball court, I just felt like I did not belong, and it probably, my work ethic probably wasn't where it needed to be either. So I found my first year at Notre Dame to be very challenging, and I think a part of me was probably depressed too. And I think I was homesick, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. Although I came from that chaos and dysfunction at the house, I don't want to say a part of me enjoyed it, but that was my normal. So to take me out of that environment to this culture shock. I think Notre Dame was probably a culture shock, because I went to a high school where it was pretty diverse. We had over 26 different nationalities, and it was like a melting pot, and we all meshed, and it was just different when I got to Notre Dame. So I really struggled.
Why was it different?
Like I said, it was a culture shock. I didn't see a lot of people like me, and people that I did see like me, I didn't feel like they really understood me or empathize with me, and my teammates, they definitely didn't understand me. Most of my teammates came from two-parent homes, whereas my mother's never seen me play a basketball game in my entire life. You know, so it was just different. So I felt like I was on an island all by myself, and that was very lonely for me. But the good thing is, a gentleman introduced me to a sports psychologist and by the name of Dr. Franco, and I was able to work with him all 5 years that I was at the University of Notre Dame. And it wasn't about what was going on in the basketball court. It was about putting closure on my childhood history. Because mm-hmm. don't forget, from 5 to 18, I never told anybody what was going on. So everybody thought, you know, Danielle's got it going on. She's rocking it, you know. But really, I was hurting, you know. basketball was
a release.
A release.
You know, actually, I did not come up. I came from a two-parent family. Mm-hmm. Started in the South Side, and they eventually went to the suburbs back in 1950. But I remember everybody growing up, you go through teenage years, and you're struggling. You're struggling. Who am I?
Yes.
My body's changing. My friends are doing this, and I don't know if I want to do that, and so on. Mm-hmm. That happens to everybody.
Right.
But when I went out on a pitching mound, because I was a baseball player, mm-hmm. when I was on the pitching mound and I was throwing, everything else shut down. All my problems mm-hmm. shut down because I was focusing on throwing a ball past a batter.
Right.
And it was a challenge, and it was, I zeroed in, and that zeroing in gives you the ability to zero out. You know, one of the great, great movies, baseball movies, is that one with Kevin Costner, the name of the game, or the For the Love of the Game. Mm-hmm. And in that, he's a pitcher. He's going through, you can pitch this perfect game. And as he's going through, each time, there's massive crowds there in Yankee Stadium. Mm-hmm. And he has to say to himself, start the engine, mm-hmm. or focus the engine, mm-hmm. and the mechanism. And so the way they express it in the movies is all the crowd sounds cease.
Right.
And that is what happened to me. I could, mm-hmm. all the crowd noise, I didn't pay any attention. Mm-hmm. When I was playing right, I remember talking to an All-American football, on this show, an All-American football player, and I asked him, he went through hell to get where he was.
Okay.
And he was All-American. And I asked him, when you went out on the playing field, was that really an exciting experience? Mm-hmm. Was it all, you know, all the hubbub and the cheering and all? Mm-hmm. He says, no. I said, what? He said, the only time I ever felt emotional in a game was when I was playing professional football, and my father, who I hadn't seen for years, mm-hmm. came, and I knew he was in the stands, and I was playing for in front of him for the first time. Mm. But he said, when you're out in the field, you're just, it's business.
Right.
All you're doing is what you practiced for.
Right.
And so it's the viewer's view of what's going on and the player's view of what's going on, completely
different
perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. So you played at Notre Dame, and it was when Notre Dame just got their, where they were the number two or one team in the country for so many mm-hmm. months and years. What was it like?
It was a great experience. Although I think my career, and a lot is because of my own doing, I wouldn't trade up the experience in the world. There's only a small percentage of people that can say they play Division I ball at the top. And I was on a couple of teams where we were top five, mm-hmm. and I was a part of a team that made the Final Four. And I sit here proudly to, you know, saying that, you know, I finished on Notre Dame's, when I left Notre Dame, I was their 17th all-time leading scorer. And that's after averaging a point a game as a freshman and missing my sophomore year with Achilles tendon. So I definitely paid my dues. And mm-hmm. at Notre Dame, I learned what commitment was about, and I learned what sacrifice was about, and giving it all for your sisters. Because I saw my sophomore year when it was seven ball players, because I tore my Achilles, three kids left, quit the team. Nielle tore her ACL, another kid broke her hip, and another kid hurt her hand. We were down to seven players where we had to dress the manager. We dressed the manager, but that team pulled together, and they went to the Final Four and played against Tennessee, who eventually won the 97 championship. So that was a highlight of my Notre Dame, I think, basketball career, because that challenged me to take my rehab seriously and get in the gym and work on my game if I wanted to contribute.
Okay. Now, the story you have to tell is not just about athletics. It's more something else. So what I've always wanted to know is I've talked to many athletes of different kinds of sports, and I say, what happened after? Mm-hmm. And you know that these kids graduate, and then you lose track of them.
Right.
Unless they go to the pros, then you follow them again.
Right.
But what happened to you after graduation?
What happened to me after graduation? So after graduation, I actually graduated in 1999, and then I had a fifth-year eligibility, and then I left in 2000. And I don't know why I always thought, because you have a Notre Dame education, that people are just going to come look for you and give you a job. Well, I had a hard reality check. That didn't happen. So I left Notre Dame that fully prepared, like I should have been. In all those years I had been planning, being a planner, I left without a plan. So I went back to my grandmother's house and was laying on the futon that summer of 2000, just trying to figure out, you know, who am I? You know, what was the past 5 years all about? And I had people, you know, people can be mean and cruel when you're down. Well, how can you go to school for 5 years and not have a job? You know, that really hurt. Mm-hmm. So I tried to figure it out. I tried a couple of different things, and nothing was really connecting. And finally, I interviewed for a teaching position as a physical education instructor, just to give me some time to figure it out. And so I taught kids from grades K through eighth grade, and then I became a high school basketball coach as well. And I did that for about 2 years, and I really enjoyed working with the kids to the point where I was ready to enroll into a graduate program and to become a school counselor. But along that path, I felt a void. I felt some type of void in my heart. I felt something hollow. And I always knew that I wanted to serve my country. I just didn't know when or how. And that was one of my goals as a 7-year-old. It was Notre Dame. And if you don't go to Notre Dame, then you would go to the military. And I always knew that. That's why I joined ROTC.
But you had no models in your family, did you?
No, sir. No, sir.
Why did a 7-year-old have that image, not, you know, the Notre Dame, but the image of serving your country? Why?
The commercials. That's all I can. All I can do is relate everything back to what I saw on TV, and I always saw Army commercials, Army and men, nice looking men with uniforms on. I'm going to keep it real. I'm not going to say I joined because of that, but I felt
like
that it didn't hurt. And then when I worked at the candy store, I knew people. When I was 11 to 17, when I worked at the candy store, I saw what they call weekend warriors. And audience, I do not believe reservists are weekend warriors. They serve just like we do. I would see people who they would have their rucksacks on and say, where are you going? And it's like, well, we're going to do our weekend service, or we're doing our 2 weeks overseas. And so I saw these were pictures that I put in my core memory that, hey, there are people in the community that they're serving their country. So throughout childhood, I would see these things. And even when I went to Notre Dame, I tried to join ROTC, but they said I was on a basketball scholarship. So they told me no. And the people who are closest to me, they knew that I was going to eventually join, because I always talked about it throughout college as well. And I looked at Air Force coming right out of college, but I just wasn't ready to commit at 23. But then 2.5 years later, I felt like that window of opportunity was closing. And this was something I needed to do, because I didn't want to look back at 40. I'm 40 now, and say I could have, should have, would have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I signed. I committed at 25 years old. No role models, no family examples, just something that I felt like I needed to do for myself.
Okay, so you signed up at age what, 26?
I think I was 26.
Mm-hmm. And did you go in as an officer?
No, sir. And I knew we were about to enter war. I knew I didn't know enough about the military to really lead troops. And my motto is, it's great to start off at the top, but why not start off somewhere in the middle? So at least when you make it to the top, you understand people who are below you, and you understand your peers, and then you understand people that are above you. So I started off as a specialist. So I started off with some rank as an E4. And that way I could become a non-commissioned officer, and then eventually go to officer candidate school. And when I became an officer, I could understand what the privates, the non-enlisted people, and the commissioned officers were experiencing, because I could say, well, I've been there, I've done that. So that was the thinking going in as an E4.
Then what happened?
I signed up to be a military police officer because I wanted to get downright dirty. I wanted to be in the mix, because that's that's just that's my mentality. So I went to Fort Leonard Wood.
My brother did his initial training at Fort Leonard Wood.
Okay, yeah.
In the middle of the summer, hot, awful place.
Cold.
Oh, you were in the cold.
Yes, January to May, it was awful. My first duty station was Fort Lewis, Washington, and 6 months later, we received orders that we were going to Iraq. And so in January 2004, we deployed to Iraq. I was scared. I did not want to go. A lot of people found ways to get out of going to Iraq, whether they pretended to have mental illness or becoming pregnant. People found ways to get out. And I thought about ways of trying to get out as well. But I realized I consider myself a person of ethics, and I realized that I signed on the dotted line. And that's what happens. You know, when you decide to serve your country, you're serving your country first. And if there's a war, you have to go to war first. A lot of people, I think, join for the wrong reasons. And I didn't join for benefits because I had a college education and I wasn't in debt. So I truly joined to serve my country and be a small part of history. That was part of my thinking. So once I arrived to Iraq, a lot of my fear dissipated because I was fearful. I didn't want to die because I had a premonition that I was going to get hurt. And I tried to erase that thought as quickly as it came in my head, but it wouldn't leave.
Well, you've gotten to Iraq. We're gonna take a break right now.
Okay.
When we come back, we're going to be talking more about that experience in Iraq and how it has affected your life and the life of others. This is John Smetanka, on With Respect. We're talking to Danielle Green, an athlete, and now a soldier in Iraq. Gone through fear, and we're going to see how things played out. Run with respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Danielle Green as our guest, who is a star basketball player for the University of Notre Dame women's basketball team when they were up there their climb to be one of the best teams in the country. But we're talking about her time after. We're focusing on a time after leaving Notre Dame, and now we're in the Army. This is John Smetanka, on With Respect. All right, you got to Iraq. What was your first image when you walked in, when you landed in Iraq?
My first.
Let me tell you, my brother, when he was, he did Fort Leonard Wood for his basic training, and then he did his advanced individual training at Fort Sill in Oklahoma, and then he was deployed to
Vietnam.
And as he was flying in, he tells the story that as they were flying into Saigon Airport, Thanh Nguyen Air Base, there's cloud cover. And all he could see down below were flashes of light through the clouds. And he thought, oh, my God, there's a war going on down there. Well, it turns out it was lightning. But at any rate, it was an image that stuck with him, that first entry into a war zone. What was yours?
Ooh, my first image was just stepping off the plane, and it was cold. I'm like, how can it be cold in the desert? You know, I'm thinking we're in the desert, and it wasn't that fearful. It was just the famous motto in the military is hurry up and wait. So it's basically get your weaponry and get into a formation and just stand around and wait. It was dark when we arrived. When we arrived in Kuwait, and we knew it wasn't hot in Kuwait. You know what I mean? Like there wasn't a war in Kuwait. The war was up north from what I can remember. So I wasn't very fearful. It was just like, what's next? So that was my initial thought. Like, what's next? Where do we go from here?
And what was next? What happened?
What was next? Gee, a long journey, and I don't even know how many miles from Kuwait to Iraq. And I just remember spending a couple of nights sleeping in a Humvee and just looking up at the stars, just, you know, just praying to God every night that, you know, to protect me and my team. That was the initial weeks leading up into it. And for the most part, John, it was fairly calm. It was fairly calm. We would go on some random missions. I was the company commander's gunner, so I was always outside the wire. But there was really...
What does that mean, outside the wire?
Outside the wire. So you have your compound, mm-hmm. where you have your forward operating base, and you have your barracks, and you're basically secure. You have perimeter security, but mm-hmm. once you're outside the wire, it's almost fair game. That's where you hear a lot of... You hear a lot of stuff about improvised IEDs and mm-hmm. RPGs and people on telephones detonating bombs and stuff. That's outside the wire there. And just desert miles on end. So we found ourselves always on missions because he always had meetings to go to.
When you say that you were his gunner,
yes.
What does that mean?
Well, I was his gunner, so I was in charge of different weaponry systems. Like I remember I fired a Sol 249, and I may forget some of these weapon systems. I had an M4. I carry a pistol on me, and so he sat in the driver's side, the passenger side. We had a driver, and then I was in the turret. So if something, and half my body was sticking out, so if something was to ever happen, mm-hmm. I'd probably be the first one to be shot or whatever. So I had protection, 360-degree protection over our particular Humvee. So, and then for me, that brought me great pride that here I am a woman, and you could almost say I was the top gunner in our company, and mm-hmm. I'm protecting our company commander, so... I felt pretty big about that position.
What happened?
So 4 months into my deployment, May 25th, 2004, started off as a typical hot day. It was about 115 degrees. I remember I wasn't feeling very well, just didn't feel like myself that day. We had riot training that morning because I was a military police officer. We were preparing to either go to Mosul or Fallujah to go up there to do whatever it is we were going to do. And so after we finished about an hour of riot training, we put our riot equipment up. We went back to our barracks, and I thought we were done for today. And we received orders that we needed to go to our police station. So one of our duties was going to the police station and training the Iraqi police officers and just protecting them as best we could. So we were short teams. I think we had about three trucks. And we drove to the police station. And any other day, we would have the little kids and the women. And some men would greet us when we came to the police station. But on this particular day, it was empty. There was nobody there to greet us. We went inside the police station, and there was nothing but the detainees. Even the police officers were missing in action. And I thought to myself, man, this is pretty odd. But being an E4, I kind of just, you just stay in your line. You don't voice your opinion. So... normally, we would go up to the rooftop and pull rooftop security, two stories above, and we would go up in teams, but we were short men that day, so we went up one at a time, and we would rotate in. We'd have people down below pulling security up above, and then we'd have people inside, and so it was my turn to go upstairs and pull security, and I would say about 10, 15 minutes later, two rockets almost hit the Humvee that was two stories below. And so I recall picking up my M4 rifle and getting into the kneeling position. And as I was about to turn the lever from safety to fire, something hit me. And I was already in the kneeling position. I didn't go into shock. I just lay there angry. My initial feeling was just anger because I was going to die. And I didn't want to die in Iraq. And I just remember just being really, excuse my language, just pissed off at the thought. And there was ringing in my ears. There was dust. I remember just looking in the sky, just waiting to die. I didn't feel any pain at the time. My body was numb. And so as I lay there, I realized, well, man, maybe there's a possibility that I will survive this attack. So I remember saying a prayer to God because I didn't know who else to call in that time. And I said, God, I don't know what I've done in this lifetime, but whatever I've done, please forgive me. Just give me the strength to be able to live, to tell my story to others. Because I was 27 at the time, I wanted a kid. I didn't have a kid, so there was things that I wanted to live for at the time, and so I felt like I felt a surge of energy enter my body, and I thought I could get up. But when I tried to get up, I couldn't get up, And at this point, the numbness is rubbing up, the numbness is wearing off. And now I can feel excruciating pain throughout my body, particularly my arm, which I didn't know was missing at the time. It was just a lot of mixed messages, but I could see that my left thigh was bleeding real bad. And I tried to move, but the only thing I could move was my head with my Kevlar. And so I'm in the front of the building on the rooftop. And so the back part has stairs, and my sergeant comes up, and he doesn't know that I'm hurt. And he says, "Green, are you okay?" And he's about to run downstairs. And I say, "No, Sarge, I'm hurt." And so when he came over, I can only imagine what he saw, because I didn't see what he saw. And he went into shock. I just remember his greenish blue eyes just going into shock. And I said, "Sarge, I need help. I need help." Now, I don't know who called the other soldiers to come up, but eventually some other soldiers came up and they just started, you know, feeling on me and tying a tourniquet, because I still don't know that my arm is missing. All I know is that I'm in a lot of pain and I'm thirsty and I'm hot. And so they're trying to figure out how to carry me off the rooftop. And so each person grabs a limb and they carry me down the stairs. And at this point in time, I see the Iraqi police officers and I'm thinking, wow, this was a setup. So they put me on the hood of the Humvee, and our driver, normally he's not an organized guy, but this day he was on point. We went through an alley of the city to get to a rally point where the medevac came, and they put me on the litter, and we flew across a river to the green zone. The green zone was probably 5 minutes away, and that's where the doctors, they got me together, put me out, and then I woke up several hours later.
Okay. Woo! a fellow who worked in our office was in the Army in Fallujah, mm-hmm. and so I heard stories. He was a lieutenant or a captain, and about the stories in Fallujah. And listening to yours and listening to him gives me sort of an eerie feeling about what it would have been like had I gone to Vietnam like my brother did. Mm-hmm. So I now want to take you quickly from the place where you were taken care of to what you decided to do with the rest of your life.
Okay. So I woke up several hours later and I thought I was in heaven, only because I had on all white and...
It's an angel.
And right. I thought I had died and woke up, and my chain of command was at the foot of the bed, and they were crying. And I'm like, "Why are you guys crying?" And so I looked down at my arms, and I realized that my left arm was shorter than my right arm. And there was a sergeant over here, and I said, "Sergeant, is my left arm missing?" And she's like, yeah, but it got blown off. And I remember breaking down for a little while, and then I gathered myself. And she said, "Two of your sergeants went back up to the rooftop to get your wedding rings," because I had just gotten married several weeks prior to being blown up. And she said, "Where do you want me to put them?" I said, "Put them on my fingers." So from there, I went from Iraq to a field hospital to Germany, where Mr. and Mrs. Woods, who are members of our women's basketball team, our basketball family, were there visiting their son, who happened to be my doctor in Germany. So they get on the phone and they call Coach McGraw. It's 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning. And, you know, she didn't know I was in harm's way. But I said, "Coach, all these years you wanted me to work on my right hand. Now I have to work on my right hand."
Because you're a natural lefty.
I was natural lefty. And I know she must have been like, "Oh, my goodness." But anyway, I went to Walter Reed Army Medical Center, and I arrived there sometime the end of May and stayed till about the beginning of January of 2005. And my occupational therapy was learning how to operate as a one-handed person in a two-handed person world. And it was very challenging because I had been left-handed for 27 years. But I attacked physical therapy and occupational therapy just like I attacked everything else in life. You know, I had a plan, and I had great support at Walter Reed and sports. Sports emerged as part of my rehabilitation. I learned how to play golf. I learned how to ski. I learned how to run again because I have a 9-inch scar on my thigh. So sports helped me to get out of that shell because I didn't know how society would view a combat wounded female. So as I'm planning to return home, I'm talking to my husband about, we need to do this to the house and we need to do this to that to the house, which is secure the house where I don't have to leave the house. You know, let's fix the house up in a way where if I want to do something, I have everything at my disposal right here at the house. But then I realized that's no place to live. I serve my country honorably. So if people want to look at me and stare at me and judge me, but that's on them. I didn't do anything wrong. So immediately I dismissed those ideas of being, you know, in my house, staying in my house. That was no way to live. So I took 6 months off from January to about May to figure it out. And in May, I started school. I went back to school and I to work on a master's degree in school counseling. I was going to pursue that path that I originally set out to do. So I studied school counseling at St. Xavier University in Chicago. And I worked.
I went there too.
You went there too?
I did.
Wow.
I did. Go ahead.
That's my alma mater. Yeah. So, yeah, I went there from 2005 to 2008. All the while I was working at Chicago Public Schools as a citywide sports coordinator. Once I completed the program, I was ready to move on. I went to Malcolm X. I worked at Malcolm X for a little while, 6 months, and then I realized that, you know what, athletics was once my passion, but I don't want to work in the industry. So somebody said, have you thought about becoming a readjustment counselor? And I said, what's that? You know, I had never really thought about the VA. You know, I didn't really know too much about the VA at the time. And I said, you know, I'll fill out an application.
Okay. VA. We're going to be talking about VA and mm-hmm. you and also other people that you've been working with. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break right now. This is John Smetanka. We're talking to Danielle Green, who is a former basketball player, but now is going to be talking about what happened to her after she lost her arm as a soldier in Iraq. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Danielle Green, former Star College basketball player, but now most importantly is working with the Veterans Administration and talking about, we'll be talking with her about the impact that her prior life has had on her work with others. So, this is John Smetanka. Danielle, the VA has gotten a lot of very, very negative publicity in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And apparently some of it well-deserved. Certainly at some institutions, waiting lines, lying on that sort of things. And we look at the VA and we seem sometimes to think it's the most troubled agency that we have in the federal government. It seems to have, everything seems to go wrong. And you wonder, what's it all about? What is VA? What is the Veterans Administration? What are the good or the bad points that you come across? And what did you do? What do you do?
Well, for the past several years, I was a mental health therapist. So I would work with those veterans and family members who were the veterans who returned from combat with PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder or anxiety disorder or depression or any type of mental illness that they incurred while they were overseas. And I enjoyed this work greatly because I felt like I was continuing to serve. You know, I served 23 months in the military, and I just wanted to figure out how to give back to my brothers and sisters. And so my counseling degree, it served its purpose to work with those men and women struggling with those disabilities. I work for a part of the VA that is called Vet Centers, and they welcome home those combat veterans. Absolutely love the position. I sometimes when I reflect, and I use the VA as well for my prosthetics, and I like to say no system is perfect. You know, many systems are flawed. Sometimes I think, in my opinion, I think that the VA is big. It's just too big. I feel like it's top heavy. It's multi-layered, very bureaucratic. Those are just a few of my thoughts, but we are one of the few countries who care for our veterans when they're done with their service. I went to Ireland several years ago, and I talked to troops from other countries, and they don't have a VA. So if you get injured and you come back, well, they rely on foundations or private funding to support those veterans who have injuries or mental health issues. So, you know, people can talk badly about the VA and say we need to be doing that, this and that. I'm thankful that we even have a system, because so many countries do not have a system. And so it makes me wonder, what are they doing over there? Maybe we have something over here. So I think it's a great system, because we provide more than just healthcare. We provide educational benefits. And what I do for the VA now, I'm not a mental health therapist anymore. I'm a field examiner. I didn't realize when a combat veteran passes on, his surviving spouse is entitled to benefits.
Mm-hmm.
The VA gives the surviving spouse, and that's the part that I work for. I work for Veterans Benefits Administration. So you have this negativity on the news about, you know, the long waits and people dying waiting for appointments, but we're not highlighting some of the success of the VA as well. So like I said, no system is perfect. I'm proud to be a VA employee. I'll probably retire doing this work because I do see the good in the system, and it's been very good for me in acquiring prosthetics and medical care. And some of our people, our veterans or soldiers, they're not able to work anymore. And if we didn't have a VA, who's going to flip that bill?
Yeah.
So.
All right. You have talked now about the benefits that you got from, or you're getting from the VA, and you're giving to people who are veterans. What's the interchange? How does your giving benefits, giving help to others who are similarly situated to you? They've lost arms, legs, PTSD. What has that done for you as a person? What does it, I mean, all right, let me put it this way. I've been a lawyer for 40 some years. During that time, I have seen many, many people who are hurt, who are hurting. That is, they hurt other people. And I wonder, there's no easy way to tell people when they ask you, well, what's it like to be a prosecutor? What's it like to be a defense attorney? There's no easy way to describe all the different textured experiences that you have. And I know that, for example, I spent 25 years in prosecution, and now I'm in private practice for 20 years. And so I've seen a whole different side of every problem. And I would tell people, the first thing I would say is, I would be a better prosecutor today than I with my experience in doing defense work and in private practice, because I see the other side, and I see the hurting from a different angle. But we hurt each other.
We do.
And somebody, you know, you talk about the good thing about the VA, that they are there, that
they're
they
there.
Exist. Has that made a change in you, working with the VA and helping people?
You know what, John? I think it's part of my fabric, because if I wasn't working for the Department of Veterans Affairs, I would be a school counselor. I would be in a school helping our youth. And our youth, God knows, our youth needs, they need more help than ever now with everything that's on TV and the negativity and these reality shows and all this stuff. They need me too, but if I wasn't with the VA, I would be with our youth. But it just so happens that, you know, my passion and my purpose right now is with the Department of Veterans Affairs. This is, like I said before, this is my way to continue to serve my country in a different capacity. Because if I wasn't hurt, maybe I do 20 years with the military, Who knows? But this is my way of giving back to my brothers and sisters and showing them that, you know what? Life isn't fair. You know, I wouldn't wish this on anybody, but life isn't fair. But you know what? Good can come from this. And I want to show people the good from war. Yeah, war is ugly, but not all of us come back with those mental scars. I have the physical scars, but not the mental scars. And so I need to be able to project strength. And that's why I love my job as a readjustment counselor. It just became too much for me after a while, because when you see people hurting and people hurting other people and people not getting the benefits that they want or need to survive, it hurts you. And you carry a part of that, and you have to be able to have self-awareness to detach from that. And that's what I did when I left mental health and became a field examiner. But it makes me feel good about myself that I'm still, you know, serving, and it makes me feel full.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because you're one of the first people who's admitted to me what I've seen in professional life. I've known many lawyers, former assistant prosecutors who went on to become judges or in private practice or whatnot, and on the surface, they tell you, oh, everything's just great. I love what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And then you get to talking to them privately, and they say, I'm so tired. I can't take it anymore. I can't arraign another drunk. I will. And unfortunately, that hurts their performance. Mm-hmm. But they can't, for whatever reason, they can't get out of the rut. And I always thought that it would be a good thing to be able to have a retreat for those folks,
right,
who they're burned out, and they could. I don't know. I'm not trying to say we could cure them, but at least give them some relief,
right? Correct.
And some. And for example, you know, you in some article I saw that when you're trying to get through to people that you're dealing with, your counseling, that life isn't fair, and I've had problems too. You actually took off your prosthetic and then said, hey, look, you know, I'm real.
Right.
This is not my born arm.
Exactly.
And I went through hell.
I did. You know, wondering how, you know, society, like I said, how society going to view a woman. And I've had some stares, and I've had people say, boy, you're stupid. I would never do that. You know, and it's hurtful, but I know what I had to, I knew who I was and what I had to do to feel fulfilled.
One last question.
Yes, sir.
You are touted as a hero. You won the Tillman Award for being a hero. Mm-hmm. You have done a number of things in your life, which other people will stand outside and look at you and say, well, that's a hero. You know, and I know, that being whatever, a public figure, whether it's this movie star or a TV person or a prosecutor or a basketball player or a hero, there is a reality inside of you that's different than the people look out at from the outside.
Absolutely.
And sometimes that hero-ness can wear thin. Mm-hmm. How do you feel?
I don't feel like I'm a hero. I feel like I signed my name on a dotted line just like millions and millions of other soldiers or airmen or sailors. I just feel like it was my duty. You know, that was my purpose. I'm flattered that people think I'm a hero, but to me, I'm no different than the veteran to my left and right. We had a calling to serve. We had a calling to serve, and that's how I look at it. I don't want to dismiss when people say that, but I don't feel like I'm a hero. Okay. So Danielle, I say thank you.
Danielle Green, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It's a very interesting story, but most of all, it's an interesting person I'm talking to across the table.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure to be on the show.
The name of our program is With Respect. We're on every Sunday and Thursday. And remember our motto, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you. This was recorded in the studios of WRHC in Three Oaks, Michigan.